This is Camille Kajiri, and you're listening to Gallifrey Public Radio. And so you should. Keep your finger on the button and don't stop listening, because there's nothing better anywhere else.
I'm Josh Liston from On The Bubble Podcast, a proud member of the Gunna Geek Network, just like the show you're listening to now. The opinions expressed are those of each individual host. Check out all the other podcasts at GunnaGeekNetwork.com and get ready, because geekiness begins in 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to Gallifrey Public Radio, a podcast dedicated to positive enjoyment of everything in the Doctor Who spectrum. Join us each week for discussions ranging from Hartnell to Whittaker and beyond. Your GPR hosts are Jay Whitten.
Safety measures are for chumps who don't know what they're doing.
Kier Hansen.
Oh, hold on. I saw it on my mixer. I turned up the suck. Hold on.
And Haley Malley.
I feel like I might need to carb up for next week's episode.
Oh, and
spoilers.
We do discuss recent news, episodes that have already aired in their home territories, and the occasional interesting rumor. But don't worry, if we look too far into the future, we'll give you a fair warning.
Welcome to episode 302 of Gallifrey Public Radio, where there's something lurking just around the corner of the calendar. We can't see it, but we know it's there. We've never met it, but we're certain it's not here with the welcome wagon. We don't know how to avoid it, but we really know that we should. Oh, wait, sorry. Political ads have been running for months now. This must be an old copy. I'm Jay.
I'm Kier.
And I'm Haley. And this week we're riffing a bit on the statements made by Series 11 Doctor Who producers, Young Master Chibnall in particular, regarding the absence of familiar adversaries in the season to come. We don't know if certain baddies are on hiatus, mothballed indefinitely, or will be addressed on a case-by-case basis as seasons progress. But for the moment, it has us wondering, who else?
Yeah, really. So before we get into the whole discussion for the night, let's take a moment to welcome a new voice to the GPR studios. Well, not exactly a new voice to the podcast, but a new voice to the GPR staff proper. So welcome officially aboard, Charles Martin. Charles.
Lame Canada.
We will, Steve. Often.
Yes. And regularly. Yeah, we had to bring a token Canadian on board so they didn't kick us out of the Gunna Geek Network.
Exactly. Yeah.
Also, well, it's because of the whole negotiations with NAFTA. But anyway, I am so very pleased to be here, a refugee from the late lamented Happiness Patrol, but I'm very happy to be on Gallifrey Public Radio.
We are more than pleased to have you and honored as well. So, as we mentioned, we have a little bit to chew on with regard to Mr. Chibnall's statements at SDCC and consequent interviews and press junkets since. The reassurance that we will not be seeing recurring characters, sort of this hammering home of the brave new frontier of Doctor Who. And specifically, this has a lot of fans, well, I should say, some fans concerned, some fans outright rankled that they will not be seeing instances of things like the Daleks, the Cybermen, the Master slash Missy, or any of these recognizable counterparts for the Doctor to work off of or to work against with their new friends. So I guess one of the safest ways that we can start to unpack this is to look at where a lot of these concerns, comments, complaints may be coming from as far as the pros and cons of having or not having recurring characters, recurring. I hate using villains because it's not always villains. I wouldn't consider Missy at this point a villain, but you know what I mean.
So more like a frenemy.
Antagonists?
Yeah, frenemies, antagonists, sure. Yeah, your adversaries. What would be some things that you would say are the let's feed the bear for a second, the drawbacks to not having touchstone material like this?
I would say nothing for a season or two. Nothing. The show has an incredibly long history of letting their old enemies retire for a while. Very often back in the 60s and 70s, it would be 5 years or more between Dalek appearances. And this is all part of tradition. And I think in keeping with Chibnall's idea to reintroduce the show, which is exactly the same thing we did with Matt Smith, exactly the same thing we did with Chris Eccleston. Keep the old reliable enemies to a minimum for a while. And in this case, he's going a little bit further. But as far as we know, he's only said they're banned for this season. So we don't know what next season will be.
True. It's, you know, everyone complains about how long, the, you know, how many times the Daleks pop up and this, that, and the other. And then when we finally have someone that, you know, has the wherewithal to say, oh, we're not going to do it. Everyone's up in arms all over. You can't have Doctor Who without the Daleks. What are you talking? I think that this could be a good thing. But then again, you have people, you have the purists, you have people, you're already changing the Doctor's gender, and we've got people all up in arms about that. Now you're not going to have the Daleks. Now you're not going to have the Cybermen. It's just, there's a huge chunk of the fandom that, whether we want to agree or not about how valid they are to the, their concerns are and stuff like that, that they have legitimate concerns about how the show is changing, the drastic changes that the show is going through.
If you haven't figured out that Doctor Who is about change yet, I don't know what to tell you.
Yeah, you've been doing some very selective viewing, right?
Yeah, this show is about change, and the fashions come and go. I'm not worried that we've seen the last Dalek story. Let's put it that way.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I just to play devil's advocate a little bit, not in regard of any sort of defense of the salty butthurts or anything of that sort, but the.
I got their first album, Salty Butter.
Wasn't that Tom Petty's first breakout? No, anyway.
I think so.
But the idea of if you need to give any sort of reassurance to the existing, not that I'm trying to play any favor to them, but the idea of making sure that there are some tried and true aspects. Is there anything to be said for the idea of the leaving some degree of familiarity in there, giving the doctor as your character something to say, I've dealt with this before.
But the doctor does that when it's something we've, as the audience, have never seen before anyways.
Okay.
True.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But one thing you've talked about before, Kira, is if you change everything at once and then the show seems to not be working, it's hard to say what is not working. So
True.
We're changing so much right now, and to also be changing all of our villains at the same time, it's going to be difficult to pinpoint, like, oh, that it was that new villain. That's why that particular story didn't work. Or, you know, was it something else? Was it something in the script? Because, you know, we've got mostly all new writers. Was it something in the cast? We've got an all new cast. Was it something in the style of the show? We've got an all new showrunner.
Right. And effects department.
Yes. All new effects department. All new music.
They can make all those corrections in the following season. We already know the show has been renewed for the season after this one. So if they need to tinker with the formula, this is exactly what happened in 1970.
Get off my lawn.
Here comes the cranky old man.
Well, first the earth cooled, then the dinosaurs came, and they all got fat.
This is exactly what happened in 1970. The show went color, had a completely different doctor, completely different production cast, all new cast, everything different. Mm-hmm. And introduced some new enemies, at least at first. And then they did the opposite of what Chibnall's doing. They said, hey, you know what we could do? We could have the same villain every story. That's what we could do. So you want to talk about a failed experiment. I mean, I love Roger Delgado and I love the Master, but that petered out, let's put it that way.
It did run a little long in the tooth. So what about the whole idea of then the positives on the idea of stepping back and saying, well, the first thing that springs to my mind, two. One is just an adage, the absence makes the heart grow fonder. And we've talked about this when it came to the complete absence of the Time Lords for a long stretch. You know, we locked them away in the Time War, and it became a real novelty as a new little piece of information about them came forward. Now, I'm sort of lumping them into the adversary category right now because that's kind of where they stand right now. Yeah. They have been very adversarial. But the other thing that springs to mind is a whole idea of the new creations, the new concepts, the new directions for how to terrify, engage, and really draw in your audience are the things that some of Moffat's greatest hits, if you will, were born from. You know, if this happens to be the weeping angels, the silence, the, you know, and things of that sort. These are things that were entirely from his idea of taking something that was a base, a very primal fear, or even something that was a fear from childhood, a youth based concern or worry. The thing under the under the bed, the monster in the closet, and blowing it out to something that is not only tangible, but rational. I can understand where that comes from and why this is a basic fear, and then he would just work the hell out of it. So who says that Chibnall doesn't have, or any of the writers that he has in his paddock right now, have the same sort of the next great idea waiting to come forward?
Well, this is the thing. I think that the show does. The show constantly needs new monsters. Usually you sprinkle them in. But again, it's been done before that every monster was a brand new one. The first 3 years of Doctor Who were all like that, for example. And you build mythology some years. And in particular, Chibnall said in many interviews that this is a reintroduction year, as is usually the case with new doctors. But in this case, everything's changed. This is the most complete change in the show we've ever seen since 1970. And so this is a time to build up new myth around Jodie's character. Then you introduce some old monsters every now and again. I suspect we'll get them pretty few and far between as Chibnall goes along, but I'm glad to see some more myth building. It's good.
Mm. Now, Haley, I know from your stance and your approaches as you walk into this, you knew your basis, your understanding of the mythos from New Who exposure. I mean, just going through it chronologically, but knowing it in its entirety from 2005 forward. And even then, we had, at least in the early stages, there was some sort of from Rose, the Autons had been faced before, but there wasn't really a whole lot of time spent saying, I dealt with them, 30 of your Earth years ago or things of that sort. It wasn't addressed that way. When Robert Sherman's Dalek episode came around, it wasn't something where we knew that there was a background, but it was nowhere near any sort of a, let me tell you the tales of what they were, and we go into a flashback sequence or something.
Right. There wasn't a cut to a black and white scene in the middle of the episode or anything.
Correct. So I'm wondering, in this case, you could do the same sort of a treatment as far as, and as y'all were just saying, the idea of the doctor stepping forward and saying, I have knowledge of this particular adversary, or I've seen this before, or I've dealt with them before, and then all your curating fans are going to jump up and say, no, the doctor's never seen that enemy before. Well, okay,
sorry. Is that what they sound like? Is that what we sound like?
Precisely, yes. That's before the blow dart takes him out of the back of the neck. Thank you, Graham Burke. That was an excellent idea.
Remember, Matt Smith's doctor ran off on his own for a couple centuries, and we didn't see those adventures.
Precisely. And hey, look, Big Finish inventing villains all the time for the spaces in between.
Yes, I'm still waiting for Bob the Fish.
Oh, Bob the Fish.
So what about the whole aspect of... I guess it's a matter of, Chibnall doesn't exactly have a stellar track record with writing science fiction villains.
I don't know. I'd argue that. I thought Cyberwoman was frickin' terrible, but I would say that most of his other work, especially in other shows, he certainly knows how to write villains. He wrote half a season of Law and Order UK, for example. Mm-hmm. Nothing but villains there. Broadchurch, obviously, has that's an example of a series with one main villain. And he wrote, more than just that one Torchwood story. He wrote a lot of them.
Right.
Plus, needless to say, Life on Mars. So, yeah, he can write villains.
Okay. I think within, if I just bracket that within science fiction, so we'll take Torchwood, granted, because some of those were actually pretty well crafted, and I'll take even as far as Life on Mars, in terms of playing more the psychological mm-hmm. adversary. He tends mm-hmm. to go cerebral, given the room to do so. He had that room in Life on Mars because that was his project as far as his encapsulation within it. Torchwood, he had a stretch going where he could really kind of flex a little bit and try some things out. So if that's going to be the case, well, this is right into the thick of it. What do we think could be some areas where, regardless of anything else that's going on this season with all of the other changes, what do you think might be some areas, some unexplored territory that might play to Chibnall's strengths or those of the writers that he has on hand? That could be really interesting to see. Something maybe we've heard in an audio, maybe we've read it in novel form, maybe we've gone through the Titan comics and seen a particular sort of villain explored that hasn't been brought to main screen yet that might be really interesting to play with.
Well, I mean, if we're talking about Chibnall's area of expertise, wouldn't it be a child-murdering villain?
Well, yeah.
You're not wrong.
Yeah, we're going Children of Earth, yeah. Torchwood season 3 all over it.
I wouldn't mind seeing a really nihilist, you know, villain. Somebody okay. who's like the sort of guy who's, I'm miserable, so I'm going to destroy the entire, I'm just going to take everybody with me because they all must be as miserable as I am. Very psychological, very nihilist, as I say, fatalist.
You know, one of the things that Chibnall is really good at is the emotional pull. So what about a villain that you can really feel for? Somebody that you know, a little bit you can really relate to him. You can be like, I totally understand why you're there. You're wrong, but I can totally understand that. So that when they lose, you're like, I'm glad the Doctor won, but man, that's rough.
It becomes a perspective game.
There's a great quote out there about how a good villain is the hero of his own story.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And somebody should nail that to Chibnall's office. That would make a very fertile ground to explore.
You know, one of the complaints we had through Moffat's run was that death didn't mean anything. I think it's probably safe to say that the same will not be true of Chibnall's run. So I think we could end up seeing a very dark villain given the consequences of death in Chibnall's universe.
Chibnall can be the iced tea of showrunners. He's just all body count. If that's the case, well, we also know, though, that he steps back. Now that we know the writing roster as far as, you know, who's taking the helm, what we don't know yet is how much of a governing hand he'll be, you know, enforcing as far as edits and steering corrections along, keeping each episode within any sort of arc or theme that's running through the season proper. He did say, and Matt Stevens echoed this as well, both on panels together and separately, that there is a specific attention to encapsulation of the stories so that each one can be enjoyed in and of itself. It can be approached by audience members of any familiarity with the franchise in and of themselves. But I still imagine that because of the fact that he does love playing the long game and he loves tinkering with what you know, what you think you know of characters along the way, thinking Broadchurch in particular here, not always a matter of trust no one, but do you truly know the person standing next to you is something that he loves toying with. In multiple programs, multiple series, that some of that has to bleed in here. So as far as adversaries, and Jay, to your point, and I think you and I are going to, this is a hill we're going to die on for a long time, about having the villain that you can say, you know what, I don't agree with you, but I get you, is something that I think they would do extremely well with. The issue is, if I think of some of the ones that have been, and granted, just because of the sheer volume of material they crank out, Big Finish has had the opportunity to play with a lot of these different sandboxes, that they've given us some ideas for characters that I could see. Something like the 11, you know, that is a Time Lord that is having that has cognizance of previous iterations and has been driven mad because they are all within their head at the same time. Mm. I'm gonna play with semantics for a second, and I just want to see what y'all think of this.
I know exactly where you're going.
Well, recurring characters, okay, familiar characters. Does that mean within the modern scope, or I should say within the more recent scope? Or if he pulls a Moffat and says, look how clever I am by bringing back a villain y'all didn't know I was going to even, like, wasn't even on the radar. I'm going back 20, 30, 40 years and bringing back a one-and-done villain modernized.
My hope for the Zarby lives on!
You know, I pictured the Zarby in the back of my head, Charles, and I was hoping nobody was going to go there. But
I was this close.
I'm thinking the monk.
Oh, I'd love to see the monk. Of course, I would love to see the monk.
Because the way that Chibnall phrases these conversations about, you know, going into all new territory, to a certain degree, it doesn't have to be the monk himself, but that sort of rogue Time Lord who's just in it for themselves. You know, you could play with the character type and not necessarily name check.
Well, except for the Master / Missy, the various rogue Time Lords that have been littered around through the series history have never been accounted for. They've all, you know, it was presumed that all of them were involved in the Time War in some way. But, you know, what about the Ronnie? Where's she? Right? What happened to Susan? There's a question that I wish somebody would explore. Did she do the pocket watch thing and become immortal and amortal, not immortal?
Yes.
And just live out her life on Earth and die?
Capaldi's going to be so cranky if somebody else gets to see Susan and he didn't.
I was going to say, I swear, if they do that, I'm going to be so mad.
He'll reach
they've got to bring her in for the regeneration sequence, you know? Mm-hmm. But my point is that there could still be, and I would expect there to be, little touches throughout the season, like there was in Series 5, for example, these little puzzle pieces that casual viewers can just safely ignore. It doesn't affect the enjoyment of the story, but, you know, the hardcore among us are like, this means Paul McCartney is dead, you see. And that over there, that's his duplicate. And so on. So you could still hearken back to certain classic elements and still keep it all new. You could still do it.
Do you consider then any exploration of the now rediscovered or reaccessible Time Lords to be off limits based on Chibnall's description of what he will and will not be utilizing?
Sounds to me like there, like all of that, of any obvious references are banned for at least a year.
Okay.
And like I said before, I'm very good with this. Mm-hmm. As long as they're not banned forever. And of course they can't be, because eventually somebody will succeed Chibnall as producer and then they'll have a different take. But even if it was for the entire time that Chibnall is producer, however long that is, I wouldn't find that unusual, because I am a veteran fan and this sort of thing used to happen all the time.
Okay.
Right? Pertwee never had a proper Cybermen story.
True. Yeah. Haley, Jay, how do you feel about the leave-ins versus the leave-outs?
You know, I'm okay with it. I think that it's, I mean, the one downside is that, yes, there's a lot going on, and if something goes wrong, it's going to be difficult to say, it was this, or if things go right, it's like, okay, what aspect was it that really worked? But on the whole, it's, you know, we talked about it at the start of the episode, is that this show is about change. It always has been. So why not try new things? You never know what we could have gotten another Dalek story instead of Blink, you know. How would that have benefited us?
Yeah, exactly.
I believe I was saying all last season that I really wanted a good new villain, and we got the monks instead. Which, okay, but like, we're not going to see them again. We don't need to see them again. I don't care what the monks are up to. So if they're doing new villains for every single story, then hopefully we'll get, you know, a couple that we can bring back in future seasons.
Well, that's exactly the plan, I believe. Is that, you know, any writer going into a 10-part season in which each story is going to have a different new villain knows that some of them are going to be the Zarby, and some of them are going to be, and one, maybe one will become a Cyberman in future, you know.
Because
mm-hmm.
We were starting to run into a problem where it was like, we have to use all of our good villains every season. So if you've got to have a Dalek story, and you've got to have a Cyberman story, and you've got to have an Angels story, it's like, that's too much. Like, bring one of them back a season, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe.
Maybe.
But if the Master shows up in every episode, that's just pure gold,
bring
right?
the Master back every season, that's fine. As long as it's Mitzi.
Although, I don't know, without Michelle Gomez, and she said that she's not doing it again, so, yeah, without Michelle Gomez, I have little interest in the Master anymore.
Yeah,
unless...
she's got another new show coming up. I don't remember what it was, but I remember
she's
thinking
playing,
it looked really interesting.
She's playing Madam Satan in the revival of Sabrina the Teenage
That's
Witch.
What it was. I was like, oh, I'm in.
So different from Missy.
Let's say Missy, Madam Satan, Missy.
Real stretch there, Michelle.
Yeah. I don't know if she can pull it off. I don't know.
I don't care. I'll listen to her read the phone book if that's what she wants to do with her life.
Exactly. What a one-trick pony.
I'm going to tell her you said that.
She'll be very hurt.
I'll die happily as she stabs me to death.
Asking you to tell her something nice.
What a way to go. Well, all right. Then I guess we're all in agreement that it's a good gamble to take, mm-hmm. But one that is... I'm going to take this as given. It is going to ruffle loads of feathers. Yeah. Rightfully so.
Temporarily.
Let it do that. Yeah, because this is the way that you slough off the aspects of the fandom that gives fandom a capital F at the beginning of it. You know?
Well, this is the thing. We've already been through one of these poop storms.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember what our rating is on GPR.
So. You're doing just fine.
We've been through one of these already. What? Doctor, a woman? And you know what? Give her a story or two and it'll all be fine. Mm-hmm. I was one of these guys, not about Jody, about Matt Smith. I was like, no, he's younger than me. That, no, no. Is he even shaving? No, no.
You can still ask that question about Matt Smith.
And then at the end of the 11th hour is like, ah, I'm in love. You know, that's what happens every single time.
Yeah.
I wonder how many hardcore poo-pooers are left to peel off after the announcement of a woman as the Doctor.
They're smart doing it early, right? Yeah.
It's so funny to hear them hanging on. They stick around just to grumble.
It's like, didn't you already swear you're never watching another episode of the show again? Why are you still talking about this?
It's the 8-year-old that's throwing a tantrum that is standing in the doorway saying, "I'm leaving."
Yeah, very much.
I'm going home.
Said,
well, go.
I'm leaving.
Take your freaking toys and go.
As the old man would say, a woman as the Doctor. Color ruins
Girls
the
can't
show,
play
as far
ball.
As I'm concerned.
Well, we're not done debating because we've got a whole nother topic if y'all want to take a bit of a left turn on the highway here.
Let's do it. Cross seven lanes.
All right. Absolutely.
Sure. Just close your eyes and yank the wheel. We know, as we discussed, we're all sort of in agreement that we're rather pleased with the transition to Sunday. Charles, mm-hmm. you'll just have to catch up with us here. We're collectively rather pleased about the transition to a Sunday.
Me too.
Broadcasting.
I'm on.
Okay, cool.
So, does anybody actually watch live TV anymore? I didn't.
Another part of the discussion we've all already had. Nope.
Exactly. But the one aspect, though, that has, as of recording day here, still not been even bandied about at any sort of official level is the time slot that it'll have, whether we're talking native to the UK, across the rest of Europe, or across the pond. So... Mm. I wanted to take just a couple of minutes and pick everybody's brain here about the pros and cons. Well, maybe not even the pros and cons, just the obvious obstacles with airing at various timestamps around the day. Because of the fact that I know within Great Britain proper, they are concerned about the balance between family accessible programming and... having it on at a time slot that's too late for younger viewers to even get a chance to catch it because it's Sunday evening at that point and their TV time has been taken away from them. Why this is still a concern anymore, I'm not entirely certain, but maybe that's just because of the fact that my particular demographic is no longer really concerned with live airtime anymore.
I think this is way less of a thing than it ever was. But if you really want to go traditional, then put it on in the UK at tea time between Jukebox Jury and the Match of the Day, just like you did in 1963. And so Europe gets it at tea time, and North America gets it in the early evening, West Coast America gets it in the late evening, and Australia gets it the next day, because that's your own fault, Australia. You're over there.
Or, as is tradition, like 4 months from now.
Exactly.
I remember when we had to have camera copies brought over so that we could see the new episodes in less than 2 years' time.
So let's sort of work this across the international dateline here. So if we take it within the UK proper and they're being given something that is early evening broadcast, and by that I'm gonna consider that, and this is just by my personal standards, to say something between 6 and 8 p.m.
Okay.
If that's going to be the case, as opposed to late night viewing, which gets into anything from 9 o'clock onward.
Right.
Obviously, you've lost all of your youth viewers if you're putting it on anywhere after 8 p.m. But there's the concern about, you know, do we tack it on to the tail end of something else that where we already have a homegrown audience, so they just leave the dial where it is? Is it a matter of we want to make sure that this is something that the family can rally around, and it's one of the last little, okay, everybody's had dinner, we've, you know, the children have packed their bags for school for the next day, and now we can all sit around and watch our family program together, and then the kids toddle off to bed while the parents watch porn or whatever. I don't know.
This is some sort of fantasy world that never truly existed.
Yeah,
even if the family were all in the same room, they would all be watching it on different devices. So, no, I think what would be very nice is for BBC Worldwide to make the episode available as soon as it's done transmitting in the UK.
As soon as it's done.
See, I was thinking air it everywhere at the same time.
Well, that'd be nice, but
Haley,
pick a
play
time.
This through, because I know where you're going with this. So yeah. Play this through. Take
All
me
right,
through
so
this.
So I've said this before. So it's you just went through the times. So I don't remember what they were, but it's airing at prime time or whatever in Britain. So like early afternoon here, noon,
yep.
lunchtime, whatever.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So the hardcore fans will watch it at noon if that's what time you're airing the new episode, and then you rebroadcast it in prime time and catch that audience, and you're still getting, you know, your live plus three ratings, which I think is what people care about now, or live plus same day at least.
Mm-hmm.
And you're not really missing out on anything, because we've seen what's on BBC America in the afternoon on a Sunday. Like, how many reruns of Doctor Who or whatever Star Trek they have the rights to can you show? Like,
the problem is you're talking about West Coast would be having to get up early to watch it.
That's true.
And that's fine.
And
like
never mind Australia.
I am West Coast, so I can lay in bed and watch TV at whatever time. And
oh, man.
So,
Doctor Who and waffles in the morning?
Yum.
How awesome would that be?
But again, we've talked before, very few people are watching the TV live now anyways. So it just becomes available earlier. It can be sitting on my DVR when I roll out of bed at noon on a Sunday.
Mm.
Yeah.
True.
If it were up to me, I would have the BBC make it available for download or purchase or whatever you want to call it, you know, midnight, the day of broadcast.
Ooh.
The people who want to watch it at a traditional time, this frees them up to watch it for the BBC to schedule it as a live broadcast at, you know, dinner hour or whatever time they feel is best, because the hardcore fans will have gotten it at 12:01.
So you're saying that there's a possibility that the digital audience will have it long before it ever airs proper?
Well, it could. They have the option of getting it.
That's a huge paradigm shift.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, remember the rumor that was going around that all 10 episodes would be available all at once?
That was
binging?
Wishful thinking.
Yeah.
It was a terrible idea. But I'm so glad they didn't do it.
Well, what about kind of following HBO's model and saying, okay, we're going to air it prime time or whatever at in the UK, and we'll air it prime time in the US and whatever, but it'll be online as soon as it airs in the UK. You can watch it on BritBox or whatever it is that they want to port it to.
Hmm.
you know, do it that way. That way, anyone that wants to have access to it at the right time does. But it's still, you're still hitting the prime time viewing times that they're so concerned about for some reason.
Okay. Well, the only ratings that count really is, I mean, there's profit, there's international profits and so on, but the only ratings that actually count are in the UK. That's all they care
right.
about.
Right.
Is the yeah. bar.
Well, that's not all BBC America cares about.
No, but...
But it doesn't matter. Who's paying for the program to be produced in the first place?
Yeah. But aren't the other networks paying, like, syndication fees or something?
Well, yes, but that doesn't go to the BBC directly, you see. This is a long, boring story, but essentially all the money collected for Doctor Who sales to other countries goes to a different part of the BBC and doesn't directly affect the funding for Doctor Who in right. England.
So as well as the program does globally,
your stunness, I sympathize with. I know. Makes
I feel
no
like
sense.
I need a flow chart.
Yeah.
it's a funnel where we're not at the bottom.
No, we're at the top, dumping money.
The point is there's two audiences for Doctor Who. There's the casual viewers, which is a very, very large number, and much larger than the fan viewers. And then there's the fan audience. The fan audience wants it at 12:01 a.m. the day of broadcast worldwide, and then the casual audience will want to see it at a specific time.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And that's mostly in the UK, and again mostly for ratings. Even Britain's ratings count the iPlayer and, you know, how many views there were for a week afterwards and all that sort of thing. So I'm not sure that live broadcast ratings even count for much anymore.
Yeah. So, for as long as they do, and as long as they continue to, then we have to at least take into consideration that someone is making the programming decision that there is an ideal slot within each region of broadcast that has to be considered. So if we're looking at something where there is especially all of this attention to saying that the series itself is going to be built around inclusion and welcome and being open and accessible to this this wide audience, you know, come rediscover Doctor Who, then they need to make sure that it's airing in every market, airing at a time that audience is going to be able to see it, which means BBCA or Space or any of the other networks that are well outside of or Australia. So sorry, I keep forgetting what network you're getting your BBC programming through. Go ahead, start sending me the nasty emails now, kira@publicradio.com. Is that they are going to have to be cognizant of the same sort of programming decision. You know, maybe it's not tea time, but maybe it's 7 o'clock instead of 9 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
Or as Haley said, the whole idea of the dual broadcast. You know, if you really want to take a gamble, and I don't really know necessarily that it's a gamble because it shouldn't interfere with the viewing numbers on either one of those time slots. If it ended up being at 9 a.m. Pacific, in order to accommodate, help me on my math here, 6 p.m. Greenwich, that fine, you'll have the morning audience and you will have unencumbered, you will have your evening audience if you run it again at 7 p.m. Pacific, because those are two entirely different audiences.
The only thing I can think of is that maybe they can't sell the advertising space for as much money for that earlier time slot.
Very different market, that's true. Although, again, not every channel that Doctor Who airs on has ad space.
Yeah, well, I'm thinking primarily of BBC America, which I know has ad space because it's terrible. Yeah. Like, I last season watched my DVR'd copies of the episodes, and it was awful because they show, like, part of the act coming up as a teaser in the middle of the commercials.
Mm. I don't want to sound like a cutting edge guy because I'm definitely not that sort of person, but I gave up cable long ago.
I don't have cable. I haven't
really missed it. I use iTunes to download my I buy the episodes from iTunes, and then I buy the box set because I really want to support the show.
Right. Well, okay. So I guess it kind of stands at this point that I can see advantages from the consumer perspective. I can see the rationale from the marketing perspective on behalf of the programming decisions that need to be made, both native and international. But I don't know which voice speaks louder, because I think notoriously the individuals who make the decision for these kinds of programming calls generally have little to no regard for what a devoted audience cares. Charles, right, to your point about the fan viewer versus the casual viewer. And if they are going to insist on continuing to chase this moving target of a casual viewer, because for whatever reason or whatever rationale or criteria they're using, that this is still an important thing to put the right show in front of the right person at the right time on the right night. I mean, it's still a science, and I get it. There's something to be said for it. But
I will counter that with Game of Thrones completely changed HBO's business model.
Mm-hmm.
It was a big enough show with a big enough audience, and they were paying attention, and they completely changed the way they do things. Because before, if you wanted to watch a show on HBO, then you had a cable subscription and you paid for it as a premium service. And because of the popularity of HBO and the rampant piracy that went along with it.
I was going to say, it was less HBO and more piracy than anything.
But it was HBO paying attention to that and taking that into account. They developed a streaming service that was basically built to get Game of Thrones into people's hands in exchange for money. And I have a hard time believing someone somewhere along the way and some entity of BBC is not paying attention to the same thing and seeing if we air it 10 hours earlier in Britain versus, you know, West Coast US, we're going to get this much piracy, and that's going to cost us X dollars per episode in whatever way they make money. Science, math, numbers.
Mm.
Yeah, I'm with you. I agree.
Yeah, we might have to call in some
The good news is
brains.
That this dilemma will be resolved at some point, and then we'll know, and then we get to complain.
Yes. Well, of course. Because whatever they come up with, we're not going to be pleased with it.
Oh, God, no.
That's right.
Why would we be?
What else
would
we talk about?
Please download the Doctor Who chip into your skull, and the episode will appear immediately upon airing worldwide.
Wait a minute. Do I have to go to an in-network doctor for this? Hold on. I don't have socialized medicine. Wait a second. This sounds like a gimmick. Anyway. All right. Well, we're just going to have to stick a pin in it because it'll probably be about another, let's see, as we're nearing in on this with about 3 weeks to go. Oh my God, 3 weeks to go.
Don't even get me started on how long we've waited for this.
All right. Jay, do you think it's time to flip the switch?
Oh, absolutely. It is news time.
All right. Let's news this up. I guess we would be remiss if we did not at least, as positive and upbeat as we try to maintain, there are times when we have to tip our heads for a second and note the passing of somebody who's been important. I would say important along the development of this series that we love along the way. Charles, I'm gonna hand this over to you so we can give a little bit of an explanation about the importance of the passing of Xenia Merton, whom we know at least within the Whovian scope from Marco Polo.
Yes, the first of all, Marco Polo is one of the lost stories. So unless you've seen the reconstruction, you won't quite understand what an impact. But among other things, let me just say, first of all, she had a very wide and varied career, and I'll mention a few interesting tidbits from it in a minute. But focusing on her Doctor Who contribution, Marco Polo is one of the earliest stories. It's the first totally lost story. We do have tons of photographs, thankfully, and the complete audio soundtrack, so reconstructions are possible. And if you're the sort of person who's got any curiosity at all about the Hartnell era, I would steer you right to the color photograph reconstruction with audio of Marco Polo. It's an amazing voyage. Xenia was playing Ping Cho. This is the first person of color to have a major speaking role in Doctor Who. To be fair, it's only the fourth story, so of course. But nevertheless, she had a major role in it. Was very young at the time that it aired. She and Carol Ann Ford were both actresses in their 20s playing teenagers. But also, this was the first opportunity in one of these stories to really explore another culture on Earth from somebody who is a member, barely, of that culture. Xenia was actually born in Burma. She was not Chinese. Her father was half English, and she was raised in Singapore, so she knew her way around the place. Later on, before Doctor Who, she had some interesting roles, and also she was very briefly seen in the Beatles' Help, believe it or not.
Really?
Yeah. She was an Oriental princess in Help, and then later on, she got to be much better known as Sandra Bennis in Space 1999.
Right.
And that's her other big major role. But she had guest appearances in just about every notable British series over the years, and along with a few films, including The Adventurers from 1970 and the 1972 Henry VIII and His Sixth Wife, among others.
Now, you reminded me, actually, and I'm going to have to go back now because it was actually an episode that I loved dearly for a number of reasons, Katie Manning notwithstanding, but one of the instances of the Sarah Jane Adventures where the Doctor actually appears.
That's right. She played the Register in The Wedding of Sarah Jane Smith.
Okay. Well, all another reason to do yet another rewatch of the SJA, so I'll take it. It's unfortunate that, as we admit yet again, we are reaching a point where, on a show that has been running for as long as this has, the frequency of news items that we lose someone from the earlier stages of the production along the way is becoming, unfortunately, a part of our standard news cycle. It doesn't make it any easier to accept, but it's something that we feel that we would be remiss if we didn't mention as these events occur. So our thoughts and our condolences to the Merton household and estate, so her family and friends and colleagues along the way. So
on
a little bit of a brighter note, we have some news looking forward. We've been discussing what we do and don't know about the program proper. We do know something new, don't we?
We do, actually. The synopses for the first two episodes have been released. So,
well, speaking of
kind of sleeper, sound the vague spoiler alert.
this is officially sanctioned releases now, so this is acceptable. But I think it's interesting, you know, dovetailing with our conversation about villains and adversaries, that prior to this, our premiere episode was going to be The Woman Who Fell to Earth. Nice Bowie reference in there. Real pleased about
lovely
that.
Bowie reference.
And we get our synopsis for that. That has to do, obviously, with aliens in Yorkshire. We knew that we were going to be, keeping it northern. So, but nothing about exactly what that alien issue is, other than that it has been terrorizing people across the Sheffield area. But our second episode now, titled "The Ghost Monument," also written by Chibnall, this will be the first one directed by Mark Tondorey, will have to do with an off-planet experience. So if you consider that spoilery, sorry, you knew from the teaser trailer that we were going to get off Earth at least once. So,
there's a mystery, too. Now I've ruined it.
Oh, great.
That's why we can't have nice things.
Yeah. So still reeling from their first encounter, can the Doctor and her new friends, again, note, companions now read friends.
Yeah.
Will they stay alive long enough in a hostile alien environment to solve the mystery of capital D desolation? Capital D. Is desolation an organization? An individual?
A city? A planet?
An event?
I was going to say it's a planet.
Oh, is that like the city of Christmas? Of Christmas? And who are Engstrom and Epso? I tried to look up Epso just to see who was maybe cast in the role, and the only thing I was getting is an acronym for something really, really boring.
I'm surprised the person who wrote the synopsis doesn't know. That seems odd.
Well, so at least we've got a little bit more that we can chew on at this point as we look forward to what's going to be handed to us in about 3 weeks hence.
I'm very excited for this season. I really am. If I'd had any doubts at all, and I did not, but if I'd had any doubts, that teaser removed them entirely.
Mm.
Not the first little teaser. I mean the longer trailer, I could call it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Okay. As soon as I saw her, in action, I was like, "Yep, this is gonna work."
Mm-hmm.
That's the Doctor.
Now, to a certain degree, you really want to hope for the cone of silence. Tell us nothing more and let us come into this as cold as we possibly can.
Yeah, here's hoping.
Well, he's done an exceptional job so far.
Exactly. I mean, the fact that we're 3 weeks out and we're just now having, we can just now speculate about what a name like EPSO means. I think we're on we're on good terms right now.
Environmental Protection Zoning Ordinance.
That's correct.
Wow.
Thanks for ruining it.
No, didn't you leave an S out?
EPSO. E-P-Z-O.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
It's written right in front of you in the notes, Mally.
Oh, she didn't click the link. That's too much effort.
No, there's spoilers in there. I'm not reading that.
Oh, yeah.
Sorry. I had my headphones off for the last 2 minutes. Like,
Sorry.
All right. Well,
there's some aliens.
Other lighthearted things we've got. So Christopher Eccleston has really been stepping up his game as far as, at least interacting with fans.
And in the most delightfully snarky way.
Oh, yes. Well,
no.
Would you expect less?
No. I like this. If someone, apparently the one of this couple took it upon themselves to really, I don't know. I didn't read, there was a deeper article interview that explained exactly how one of the two grooms was able to get wedding wishes from both Chris Eccleston and Russell T. Davies.
Mm-hmm.
That aside, the tone that Eccleston puts on as far as his wedding wish, which isn't really a wedding wish at all. It's really a matter of, well, how nice, you're getting married and you didn't invite me, the person who you feel is one of the most, exemplary figures, formative characters in your entire lives. And I'm hearing about this now.
It's a short, lovely piece. He has actually done this sort of thing before for other fans, as you point out.
Yeah.
Right.
This all this myth around Eccleston hates the time that he spends on Doctor Who is exactly that. It's a myth.
Yeah.
He doesn't feel the need to reprise it on television, maybe, but he's not averse to it, and he seems to have a very large heart for the fan. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. Yeah. We'll have to see. I'm curious to know how much, because he has an autobiography that's about to be published very soon, focusing primarily on his relationship with his father, who he watched slowly deteriorate to dementia and Alzheimer's. And he's devoted a lot of his life to fundraising and raising awareness about dealing with Alzheimer's since. But I'll be curious, since it is an autobiography and it will be following his interactions with his father over the course of his career and how much of his time is spent at home versus away or abroad working on particular roles, how much of his time as the Doctor is actually referenced in there. But
also, I hope there's an apology for the G.I. Joe film.
No, you will not get that. No.
Nope.
All right. Well, another thing that we have been given as a nice little gift, it may not be a wedding toast, but at least here stateside, it's a nice thing to be able to have proper, as we can finally get ourselves a physical copy of the completed, animated, reconstructed, not just Tom Baker talking about what the script should have been, version of Shada.
Shada! Yes. You Shada.
No, you Shada, really.
It's a shout out to Shada, really.
Precisely. Charles, I'm curious, do you know anything about what that's affecting you up north?
Well, actually, funny story. As you know, Canada is an entirely different country.
Shut up.
What? For the briefest periods of time, Shada was available to us months ago.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I've had a copy for quite some time.
Okay.
It was made available for sale back when they thought they were going to launch it in the U.S. on a certain date, and then they moved it back. And then somebody went, oh, yeah, Canada, and took it off the Canadian market as well. But not fast enough. So I've seen it and enjoyed it. I think it's fantastically wonderful.
Yeah. It aired once on BBCA in the States, where it was only listed as the lost episode, as if there were only one.
Yeah.
Irony. But now you can have it in your hot little hands.
But yeah, and I, you know, it's just magnificent to hear Tom and Lala and all the original cast that are still with us recreating their parts. There was a lot of footage that really didn't make it the cut in that, I guess it was around 92 or so when Tom Baker did the narrated version. There was still some footage I hadn't seen before. The recreations were pretty good. The blend, obviously you're trying to blend between computer effects, the video that was originally shot, and the animated portions that have been revoiced. It's certainly a hodgepodge in that sense. But it's an incredibly affectionate hodgepodge, and you can just feel the love everybody had working on it oozing off of it.
Excellent, excellent.
Now I will say, just as a quick aside, the only person who is not a fan of this is Douglas Adams himself. I knew him, and I interviewed him about this very topic for Doctor Who magazine many years ago. He considered it a weak script that he had to bang out because the producer rejected his original script, long story short. And so he was never terribly happy with it. But I can't speak for him, of course, but I think he would be somewhat happier with this version.
Okay.
Because finally it has some of the effects that he knew they wouldn't be able to do.
Okay, interesting. All right. Well, and to a certain degree, didn't this serve as the basis for Dirk Gently's Holistic Detective Agency?
Like everything Douglas wrote, even the stuff he didn't like very much, he was always like, ooh, that's a good bit. I'm going to use that elsewhere. Mm. And of course, he expected that Shada would never see the light of day, so he felt free to reuse huge chunks of it.
Gotcha. Well, last item we have in the news is definitely some things that will see the light of day, but interesting in terms of keeping certain things in the dark, if you will. And that was the fact that Chris Chibnall made it known that as he recruited his merry band of writers for Series 11, none of them were given a direct indication of the change in the Doctor's gender, with specific intent of making sure that they write stories that have that didn't matter.
Yeah.
And I
think that's brilliant.
I'm so pleased. So pleased.
Yeah. Yeah. There was a quote, I don't remember where I saw it, but it was during one of the makings of episodes that used to air alongside the early new series Doctor Who. And one of them said, you don't write for you try not to write with a particular actor in mind. The Doctor is just the Doctor, and you should write it the same way, whether it's Hartnell or Capaldi. And you're right. And that is correct. That's what you should do. The Doctor, in fact, it's probably best if this Doctor was written as though it was probably going to be a white male again, because that helps smooth over the big change, which is a bigger hang up with some people than others. But I think that was actually incredibly wise.
I'm particularly pleased with Chibnall's statement about the fact that he said, looking back historically, I'd be hard-pressed to find an instance where there were scenes or moments where the Doctor's gender mattered.
Right.
Yeah.
You know? I always said if they ever did, this is before they cast Jodie, but I always said if they ever do cast a woman or some obvious minority group to play the Doctor, you deal with it in like one line and never mention it again. That's it.
Yeah.
That's it.
Excellent. Well, again, just more reassurance that we're in for some great material in just a couple of weeks' time. So, yeah,
absolutely. But next week, we're returning to our classic rewatch with The Seeds of Doom.
Yay!
More time in the cold.
Yay! this should be interesting.
Haley, as much as this is going to make you think you're watching more Ark in Space, it's not Ark in Space. It's different.
Are you sure?
Yes.
For the most part, yeah. Mostly sure.
Kind of most classic episodes of Doctor Who are a little bit.
All right. Well, this has been episode 302 of Gallifrey Public Radio. Until next week, this is Jay saying, all right, here's an ambitious crossover. I want to see the Doctor versus Deadpool.
And this is Kira saying, you know, I look forward to my role as a sniveling roadie yes man to the newly regenerated Rassilon in the upcoming season. She is going to make a great boss.
And this is Charles saying, this is a bold adventure, you guys. Grab it and run with it.
And this is Haley saying, if you bring back Missy, but if it's a different actress, is it really a recurring villain?
We'll see you guys next week.
Alzi.
Thanks.
Bye.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Gallifrey Public Radio. Join us each week for new episodes. We love getting feedback from listeners, so don't hesitate to share your thoughts with us. You can email us at feedback@gallifreypublicradio.com, tell us on Twitter @GallifreyRadio, or on Facebook at facebook.com/GallifreyPublicRadio. You can also leave us a voicemail for inclusion in future shows at 210-802-1477. That's 210-802-1GPR. You should also go to GunnaGeek.com and check out lots of other high-quality geek-centric shows, or visit forums.gunnageek.com to talk about anything geeky with us or the community.